guardian.co.uk.
Hello, I'm Nick Watt, and welcome to Politics Weekly. Well, there was a rebellious feel at Westminster this week. Protesters took their campaign against a third Heathrow runway to the roof of the House of Commons. There were jokes that the protest had been inspired by the Lib Dems, who walked out of the chamber on Tuesday.
I do not believe that.
Or given our chance.
Order, I have had enough. I've had enough. I would be grateful if the minister could get to his feet and start the debate. In accordance with the power given to me by Standing Order Number 43, I order the Honourable Member to withdraw immediately from the House for the remainder of this day's sitting. Order. I think that must be the end of it.
Yes, that was Sir Michael Lord, the Commons Deputy Speaker, as he threw out the Lib Dems' Foreign Affairs spokesman, Ed Davey, for challenging his authority in a debate on the EU. We'll be asking whether a new era of protest politics has arrived. Some things never change at Westminster, however, and the Commons Speaker is under fire once again over his expenses. We'll be asking whether Michael Martin can survive in office. Yes, that was a taste of Cuba, courtesy of the Buena Vista Social Club. Fidel Castro's decision to bow out is casting a shadow on this side of the Atlantic. Harriet Harman, Labour's deputy leader, was slapped down by Gordon Brown after she described Castro as a hero of the left. We'll be asking whether it's okay to have a romantic view of the old revolutionary and what the Brown put-down says about Harman's position in the government. Joining me to discuss these matters, we have three giants from the Westminster and media world. Flying the orange flag for the rebellious Lib Dems is Chris Hune, the party's Home Affairs spokesman, who narrowly lost out in the recent leadership election. Chris is bound to be nervous about the grilling he will face today, because he's my stepbrother. We also have the Guardian columnist Polly Toynbee and one of the top honchos at guardian.co.uk, Tom Happold. A quick question for the three of you. Were the anti-runway protesters right to take their campaign to the roof of the House of Commons? Chris?
Well, the roof of the House of Commons is obviously going a bit far, but I've got a lot of sympathy with what the protests that they were making, because the consultation was frankly a complete sham. Government knew exactly what it wanted out of the consultation. All the paperwork that's been put out to local residents, there's no box which simply allows them to say, no, we don't want any expansion at Heathrow. So I think people get very frustrated when they see what is meant to be a democratic country, so frankly riding roughshod over a consultation.
Polly?
Yes, absolutely. Very good thing that people can still get on the House of Commons. You know, we pay very little attention to protests. Actually, lots of protests are going on all the time. These days, we barely cover them.
Tom?
I think the sort of peaceful protest that Plain Stupid did on the roof of the Commons is exactly the sort of thing that makes politics vital and interesting and engaging in this country. And I think the sort of pompous reaction that Gordon Brown gave about saying that it's important that decisions are made in the House of Commons and not in the roof of the House of Commons just shows how, you know, the effect of being in power for 10 years and how pompous and ignorant it makes you about the tradition of democracy we have in this country.
Thanks for that. Well, George Monbiot, the Guardian columnist, thought those Heathrow protesters had done well.
People who think that significant political change is achieved by asking quietly and politely are grievously mistaken. If you are going to try to change major government policies in mid-course, you have to be very noisy and very often you have to be disruptive as well. And this really is how many of the absolutely critical freedoms that we and other nations have achieved over the years have come about through people refusing to be put in their place and told how they must behave with regard to their elders and betters, and standing up out of moral conviction and saying what you are doing is wrong. And if that means breaking the law, not for your own purposes, your own ends, but for a wider social good, then so be it. We cannot allow the law to set the parameters of our ethics. Sometimes things are morally right and legally wrong. And in my view, the morality of the situation outweighs any legal constraints. Now, what's going on at the moment as people protest against a third runway at Heathrow. We did something very similar in the early 1990s in protesting against the Tory government's road building programme. And when it began, we were reviled. We were told we were antisocial, vandals, we were lunatics. Everything that could possibly be thrown at us was thrown at us. But before very long, within a couple of years, we turned round the tide of public opinion. And the great majority of people in Britain ended up supporting our protest against what was a totally insane motorway building programme. Without even requiring a change of government, we cut that programme from £23 billion to £4.5 billion. It does show that a very small number of people bring to public attention an issue which is too far down the political agenda, but which is of great interest to a large number of people. That small group of people can change the politics of a country.
That was George Monbiot speaking in his garden in Wales. Chris, I have to turn to you first because you're an environmentalist, but you're also a lawmaker. There's George Monbiot saying it's OK at times to break the law, and you expressed some sympathy with those Heathrow protesters, but you're a lawmaker, aren't you? Not a lawbreaker.
Yeah, I think that George is right in one respect, which is that sometimes when you feel very strongly about something, if you're prepared to accept the consequences that the law is going to throw at you, then I think that's a way of demonstrating your feelings about it. And we've had a long-standing tradition in this country of peaceful protest going way back. I mean, actually, one of the great liberals, John Stuart Mill, was the champion, first of all, of the right to protest in public parks, because the movement for the vote wanted to be able to hold major meetings in Hyde Park. And in fact, the Tory government under Disraeli tried to stop them. And it was that, actually, which began the whole tradition of Speaker's Corner. But they had to break the law in order to make their point. But it was a point that they thought was necessary to make. And that tradition of peaceful protest, I think, is very important in a vigorous democracy.
So, Tom, Chris is saying that we have a great tradition in Britain. You were saying that Gordon Brown's response, saying we make the laws in the chamber, not on top of the chamber, is an example of the sort of the stuffy world that we live in. Do you think that sort of stuffy world response is going to encourage more protests like this?
Well, I think it will encourage more protests like this. And as Chris said, this has also come out of a process of consultation that many people felt frustrated with and many people didn't feel was a genuine process of frustration. I also suspect it comes out of the fact that people who are involved in Plain Stupid and organisations like that don't feel that there is enough of a voice of their opinions in the very divided party system that we have in Parliament. So I think we'll see more of this. I think it's, you know, a good thing. And I think politicians should be able to respond and react to it with understanding and humour. They don't have to be bullied into stuff, but they do have to sort of engage with it.
Polly, I mean, do you think protests like this make any difference? I mean, we're going to get a third runway at Heathrow, aren't we?
I think they do make a difference if they chime with a very significant feeling in the country. And I think there really is a quite profound anxiety about climate change and green issues. And actually, politicians of all parties are still putting it pretty low down on the agenda. They'll occasionally remember to make a green speech, but you don't feel that it's the number one issue for any of them. Lib Dem's better than most, but still, you don't feel it's actually what makes them get up in the morning. It's what makes them say, go out and vote for us because we're greenest. It's still a bit of an also-ran, and it isn't increasingly for large numbers of people out there, in which case protest can be very effective. Protest's a fat lot of good if it goes against the grain.
But it's interesting, Polly, about whether these protests work, because we've recently passed the fifth anniversary of the great February 2003 protest against the Iraq War. We should make the point that that was obviously a completely legal process, no law breaking going on there. And there is a big debate. I mean, it produced a great Ian McEwan novel, Saturday, but did it really make any difference? We still went to war.
No, and I think the people who write very indignantly all the time to The Guardian saying, it's outrageous, you know, millions of people, at least over a million people went out and marched and still nothing happened. Actually, we wouldn't have gone to war, I don't think, if the opinion polls had been against it. Now, people were lied to, they were told the weapons when they weren't. For whatever reason, when it came to the crunch, actually Blair did get the support of the majority of the people. And I think if he hadn't, it would have been very different. He cheated to get that support. But in the end, demonstrations aren't going to win until you win the majority of the people.
I also think it's extremely unlikely we're going to go to war again in the same circumstances, given the scale of the protest, given the fact that the protesters were right, and that the government has been comprehensively found to not just lied, but to have been totally wrong in its judgments.
And Chris, you speak with authority on this because I think you were actually there, weren't you?
I was. very proud of the fact that I think it was the first protest I've been on since against the Vietnam War, I have to say. And there are lots of us who are of that generation who were meeting each other on that particular march and thinking, gosh, surprised to see you here. But I felt very strongly about it.
I also think, with looking back at the Iraq anti-war demonstration, that was not the most effective protest of the last decade. The most effective protests were the fuel protests and the lorry drivers and the farmers barricading in fuel depots. And actually, that really did influence government policy.
Because
most of us here
opinion.
Probably didn't. Yes, it got public opinion. You know, motorists as a consumer group were very angry. And the government basically backed away off a lot of sort of punitive taxes on carbon fuels. Now, most of us here probably disagree with that, but that was a protest that really did make a difference. And it made a difference partly because it was an effective, peaceful, perhaps, protest.
No, difference it wasn't peaceful
it, because
at all.
It
was actually pretty dreadful.
It held the whole country to ransom.
But it had the Daily Mail on the side, whereas unfortunately with the anti-Iraq protest, we only had the Guardian on the side.
But that is an interesting point, isn't it, Chris, that you're suggesting that it's okay at times because we have a tradition to break the law, civil disobedience, when you agree with it, but you didn't agree with the fuel protest, therefore it's wrong.
No, I don't think so. I mean, I think that it's perfectly legitimate if you're prepared to accept the legal consequences to stretch the limits. I mean, obviously, there are points at which breaking the law becomes straightforwardly immoral. But if the law is immoral, if you feel strongly that the law is immoral, then I think that the point that George Monbiot is making is a fair one. But you do have to be prepared to take the consequences. And a lot of people are not necessarily prepared to do that.
Great. Thanks for that. Well, the environmentalists were not the only protesters of the week. We'll be asking Chris about that Lib Dem walkout from the Commons on Tuesday. But first, we caught up with Simon Hoggett, the Guardian sketchwriter, and asked him to describe the scenes.
On Tuesday, the Liberal Democrats staged a stagey walkout. They were very, very angry because the Speaker hadn't called an amendment which would have allowed for a referendum in the UK on whether we stay in Europe or not. It's some rather daft idea that they've come up with to merge the two wings of the party, the pro and anti-Europeans, and nobody takes it at all seriously, but quite rightly, the Speaker didn't call the amendment, so they walked out and looked rather silly in the process. Mr. Clegg, Liberal Democrat leader, wanted to know why we were wasting so much money on drugs, which didn't work for the mentally ill, and not enough money on giving them actual treatment. Gordon Brown gave what can only be described as a lengthy and rather evasive reply, but he did say it was very good to see Mr. Clegg here, and he hoped he'd stay to the end. Well, from Gordon Brown, this passed for tremendous wit, and it got a great big cheer from his own side, and of course cries of more. Then Mr. Clegg said that it was pointless to defend what he called clapped-out 19th-century procedures in this House. Well, ooh, they went in a very camp manner, and the Speaker got very angry. I say to the Right Honourable Gentleman he should be careful where he goes. What he's saying is that I'm here to defend these clapped-out 19th-century procedures. He may regard himself as a pretty clapped-out 19th-century figure, and he wasn't going to have some jumped-up teenage Liberal Democrat leader attacking him. Mr. Clegg said, I must say very unconvincingly, I was talking about procedures, not people. When MPs say that, they're usually talking about people and not procedures.
That was Simon Hoggett. Sorry, Chris, I've got to go to you first again. Doesn't Simon have a point? Walkouts can look a bit juvenile, can't they?
Well, Simon was doing his most snotty bit there, I thought. I mean, really, talk about drawing yourself up to a great height and peering down on the world. No, I think that the point that we were trying to make, and there was no other way to get it across, was that we had been blocked by the Speaker from debating and voting on an absolutely key part of our programme when it comes to the whole EU reform treaty. And we're basically saying we made a promise at the last election that there would be a referendum on the constitutional treaty. The closest thing to a referendum on the constitutional treaty is a straightforward referendum on whether we stay in or leave the European Union. After all, the constitutional treaty would have wrapped up all the previous treaties as well, and the Speaker denied us that vote, even though he had given the Tories day in, day out, the right to vote on the amendments that they selected. Normally, for example, on questions, we have 6 questions for the Tories and 2 questions for the Lib Dems. The Tories had had more than 6 days of selected amendments where we'd had to vote on their amendments, and we wanted 1 day of voting on our amendments, and we were not allowed it. Shows how these procedures are rigged against the third party still in the House of Commons.
Just before I bring in Polly, is it not the case that you did indeed have a vote in November on this particular issue, whether there should be a referendum on British membership in or out of the European Union? You had a vote and you lost it.
We had a vote on the Queen's speech debate, but what this is actually a legislative amendment, and we are considering the legislation. We're considering here the process by which we actually approve a reform treaty, and what happens. And it's absolutely essential, I think, that each significant party in the House of Commons ought to be able to make their point. I mean, the Tories did it day in, day out on the succession of amendments. We ought to have had that opportunity too. And this is a classic example, I'm afraid, where I think the Speaker's judgment went extremely awry.
I'd say it was also a classic example of a lot of high-horsing and grandstanding to cover up a lot of humbug and fudge of the Liberal Democrats' position on this. They got themselves in a twist because they said they wanted a referendum, and then their people in Tory seats down in the southwest, who always caused them so much trouble, wanted to support the referendum. So the best way they could hold the party together was to go for this fanciful referendum. I mean, I don't happen to think that it's a bad idea. I think an in-all-right referendum wouldn't be a bad idea.
So it's not fanciful.
No, but the whole policy and the method of putting it forward was all a nonsense. You knew the Speaker would throw it out. It gave you a chance to stamp and huff and puff up and down and pretend that you were for referendums, when actually, quite rightly, you were against the referendum that lots of people said.
That is not true. The truth is that we had long discussions with the clerks about whether this amendment was actually selectable. And we went through, we had David Howarth, the MP for Cambridge, who's a reader in law at Cambridge and has pretty hot stuff on all this. And he was in the negotiations with the clerks to make sure that this was a selectable amendment. There was no doubt about that. It was on the order paper. It was entirely appropriate for the Speaker to select it, and he didn't.
So, Tom, Chris is saying that the Speaker's judgment went awry by not allowing this vote. Do you think Chris is right, or do you think the Liberal Democrat protest really makes them look a bit sort of a marginal force in the House of Commons if they're going to walk out?
I think, you know, dear old Speaker Martin has had a terrible week, and I can only feel more sympathy to him to think that he's had to engage in long discussions about not only parliamentary procedure, but also the European Reform Bill, two of the most exciting issues in parliamentary politics, British politics,
and it's
a tough one.
About that, don't you,
I find it hard to get worked up about, and I think this is the problem with the Lib Dems, their walkout. It's a sort of, you know, huge issue of principle that it's quite hard to see if you're not in the Commons and you're not minutely involved in it, a high matter of principle. What I do slightly think is I can understand why the Speaker made the decision. It seems to me calls for votes on in or out of Europe are a way of giving people a sort of either or choice that doesn't allow them to discuss, you know, the actual intricacies of our relationship with the European Union. And actually, it seems to me perfectly reasonable to say people should be allowed to vote on the treaty for or against. And saying in or out is a sort of, you know, black or white. It's a way of sort of giving a decision and portraying anybody who is against the treaty as being a Neanderthal out of Europe. Parliament is meant to debate that treaty, and by spending a day debating whether you want to be in the EU is not actually, is a distraction from that.
We had been arguing that we should have had a referendum, for example, on the Maastricht Treaty. Those treaties which the Tories pushed through when they were in government, Maastricht, Single European Act, all the others, frankly, both the Maastricht Treaty and the Single European Act, far more significant treaties than this rather modest effort, the EU Reform Treaty. And we wanted to have a referendum on the Constitutional Treaty precisely because it wraps up all of these previous treaties as well as the Reform Treaty. And the closest thing to our promise at the election is to have that in or out referendum. So it is precisely relevant to what we are debating, what we promised as a manifesto pledge at the last election, for the Speaker to turn around and say that a party which gets more than a fifth of the votes, manifesto pledge, doesn't matter a damn, we're going to run this as if there are only two parties in the House of Commons, is frankly outrageous.
Thanks for that. And talking about the Speaker,
this House has charged me with a responsibility, and I will carry out that duty until this House decides otherwise.
Yes, Michael Martin is in the news once again over his expenses. Few MPs appear willing to criticise him, but behind the scenes there's plenty of sniping, which appears to boil down to one point, that he's not up to the job. Polly.
I think it's time he gracefully withdrew. I mean, I don't think it would be very dignified to withdraw just because the media have got up a big hoo-ha and his expenses turn out to be not out of line with everybody else's. In fact, he's rather low on the list of expenditure. So I think it would be unfair if he were drummed out. But if he were wise, he'd wait a couple of months for things to calm down and then announce that he's going to go, because I don't think he's ever been very popular or terribly good.
Tom, many of his supporters are saying that the criticism is fuelled not by people being fair to him, but by him being very snobby about his humble roots. What do you say to that?
I'm sure there's some truth in that. But I also think, you know, he's clearly not one of the great speakers. And the pickle he got in with the Liberal Democrats earlier in the week, I think, represents that. But I also think he's between a rock and a hard place in many ways, because he has stood up for a more traditional backbencher interest in protecting the privileges that they have. He's gone quite slow on reform of the expenses and resisted transparency on those things. And that is popular with a lot of the MPs. It's not popular with the media. You know, he's doing what they want, but also being criticised for it by another contingent. And I think that's very difficult. And I think MPs themselves have to actually look at themselves and decide how they want to be seen by the rest of the country.
Chris, do we have a problem here with the Speaker?
Well, clearly there is a problem of public perception, and clearly it comes at a very difficult time for the House of Commons, because the House of Commons' reputation is in pretty dire straits over, you know, MPs' expenses and everything else. And so it is not helpful that the public face of the House of Commons is also subject to such criticism, without any doubt at all. But it's a very difficult job. It's a very difficult course to steer. I myself am not sure that actually the real problem is snobbery about the Speaker. I mean, if you look at previous speakers, you had Betty Boothroyd, who was a dancer. You had George Thomas, who came from humble background in South Wales. I mean, I just don't think that actually is the reality. I think that there have been some curious signals sent out by the Speaker from the very beginning. I mean, the fact that the tradition for what these things matter in the House of Commons was that the Speaker is dragged reluctantly to the Speaker's chair by one MP from one side of the House and one MP from the other side of the House. He broke with that. Both of the people who dragged him to the chair were Labour. You know, from the beginning, there have been worries, I think, in some parts of the House about whether the Speaker was absolutely fair. In my experience, he has been. But I think that there's been a sort of rumble of discontent.
But you were saying that his judgment this week on not taking your amendment showed that his judgment had gone awry. Was that a one-off problem, or do you see that he doesn't acknowledge the third party?
Well, I'm sure even the Speaker, all-powerful though he is in the House of Commons, would admit that he's human, and to err is human. So it follows that the Speaker makes mistakes, but I don't think one can generate a case for saying that this is a systemic problem. But I do think the judgment on that issue was mistaken.
Okay, thanks for that.
Dunbarton.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. The Leader of the House and the Prime Minister's own Deputy Leader has described Fidel Castro as a hero of the left. Given Castro's persecution of homosexuals, his imprisonment of journalists, and his employment of thousands of people on phone-tapping duties, does the Prime Minister agree?
Answer! There can be no defence against the abuse of democratic rights in any country.
Yes, that was Gordon Brown making clear in the Commons that he does not share Harriet Harman's view that Fidel Castro is a hero of the left. Chris, Fidel Castro, hero of the left?
No. Joe Stalin, authoritarian dictator or hero of the left? Authoritarian dictator. Nikita Khrushchev, authoritarian dictator or hero of the left? Authoritarian dictator. No, I mean, this is absolutely ridiculous. I don't know what Harriet Harman thought she was saying, and I'm sure she would regret it in the cold light of day. Anybody who's visited Cuba would know that this was a good old-fashioned tyranny with massive problems, not least of depriving civil liberties across the country, lack of freedom of speech, lack of ability to change the government peacefully, because there's no informal or formal democracy. No, Fidel Castro is a good old-fashioned tyrant, and we should be absolutely clear about saying so.
Polly, do you think those were wise words from Harriet Harman, or should she have been a little more careful?
I think more than a little more careful. They're completely daft, and I bet she regrets it deeply. I think politicians can be caught on the hop. I must say, if you were going to be caught on the hop reverting to very, very, very old Labour, I wish it had been on 101 other things and not on this, because, of course, in the cold light of day, Fidel Castro is no hero of anybody's. I can understand why some people think it is something rather admirable and wonderful to have this little Ruritanian mouse of a country pricking the sides of America. America's never been able to deal with it. It's tried everything it possibly can. It's tried assassinations and invasions and all sorts, and somehow they've resisted the mighty behemoth, but that's no excuse for a filthy dictatorship that has no freedom of speech and locks people up, locks journalists up on a whim, and I'm sure she wishes she hadn't said it.
Tom, that's a really interesting point by Polly, isn't it? There is a slight tendency sometimes on the left for people to look at leaders who stand up to the United States and then over-romanticise them. Do you share that view, or is it right that if you stand up to the US, that makes you a jolly good thing?
I do feel, you know, there is a sense that people do have a very romantic view of Fidel Castro. You know, he's an iconic figure. You know, they're enormously romantic young men when they seize power in that country. You know, and he has led an extraordinary life, and he is a fascinating character. He does, like a lot of people you may disagree with, betray some admirable qualities. That doesn't mean his entire character is admirable, and I wouldn't agree with Harriet Harman on that. I think that attitudes towards Cuba do often reveal actually people's attitudes to the United States. But I also think they reveal a disappointment, I guess, with what has happened in many Latin American countries. Many people on the left would hope that some of the things that they do see in Cuba could be replicated in countries that have a more democratic and more admirable government. And I think people admire some of the things of Cuba, but not others.
Got this fantastic health service. The one thing Cuba has is a really good health service for everyone. The one thing that the richest country in the world hasn't got is a health service where 40 million people have no access to it.
On the whole, it's got many, many bad things, but there are elements within that society you do feel that democracies should aspire to.
Apart from President Bartlet in the West Wing, who gets his chief of staff to go and visit Fidel Castro, can I just bring the discussion down to a more parochial level, Polly, and just ask you, what do you think this says about Harriet Harman's position in the government, that Gordon Brown was happy publicly to make clear that he didn't agree with her? There are some who are saying she did fantastically well to become deputy leader, but she's not exactly at the heart of the Brown operation.
I don't think she should be at the heart of the Brown operation. It's not what she's put there for. She is there to represent the party. The party, rather to the surprise of the apparatchiks, voted for her. And they voted her because she was rather more radical than the present Brownite consensus. So I wouldn't want her to be at the heart of the party, but I would want her to be speaking up, not perhaps on Fidel Castro, but on a whole lot of other things. She is in an unassailable position. She can't be fired. She's the only one who is not dependent on Gordon Brown for her position. She is in a position, if she wanted to speak out a great deal more on a lot of other things where the party feels very uncomfortable and the Brownites are paying no attention.
I think that Harriet does represent a strand within the Labour Party, which is actually a feminist strand. And I think if she speaks out more on that sort of thing and what, you know, her female constituents are telling her and things like that, actually she would have a loud voice.
Thank you for that. Well, that's it from this week's edition of Politics Weekly. Thanks to all my guests, the Liberal Democrat Home Affairs spokesman Chris Hune, the Guardian columnist Polly Toynbee, and Tom Happolt from Guardian.co.uk. Politics Weekly was produced by Ian Chambers. I'm Nick Watt. Join us again next week. Till then, goodbye.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.